She sat on a stool beside a giant slab of marble, watching as a young man with dark hair rolled out dough on the flowered marble. "What's your pressure?" she said before lifting her gaze and smiling at Ethan. "Liege," she said, hopping off her stool. "What brings you and..." She slid her gaze my way, measuring whom Ethan had brought into her lair, then offered me a sly smile. "Merit to my neck of the mansion." Ethan placed the pizza box on a clean spot of counter. "Merit and I will be waiting on a call in my rooms. Could you arrange this and deliver it upstairs with some plates and silverware?" She arched a curious eyebrow, then lifted the pizza box, her lips twisting into a smile. "Saul's best," she said fondly, with one hand over her heart. "He got me through culinary school. And given our culinary history to date, I'm assuming, Liege, that our sentinel had some input in this choice." "It's not my usual fare," he agreed. Margot winked at me. "In that case, excellent choice, Merit." I smiled back. Margot closed the box again, then clapped her hands together. "Well, let's get this going. Something to drink, Liege? You still haven't opened the bottle of Chateau Mouton Rothschild you picked up in Paris." Being a Merit, and having been raised by my father to appreciate the difference between Cabernet and Riesling, I knew she was talking about high-dollar wine, and pairing it with junk food. "You want to drink a Mouton Rothschild with pizza?" Ethan looked amused. "I'm surprised at you, Sentinel. Given your diet, I'd have thought you'd appreciate the combination. And we are in Chicago, after all. What better to drink with Chicago's finest than something nice from France?" A girl couldn't argue with logic like that. "The Rothschild is fine," Ethan said, putting his hand at my back to turn me toward the door again. "Merit is hungry, so all due haste would be appreciated." Since he was right, I spared him a sarcastic retort, but I couldn't stop myself from glancing back to check Margot's expression. It didn't look good. Arched eyebrow, crossed arms, and much too curious stare. I was so going to hear about this later. The lights were already on in his apartments, soft music playing, and despite the season, a golden glow emanating from the fireplace in the corner. It looked like his room had been prepared by staff members for his return. Apparently, Master Vampire's got sunrise turndown service. I sat my scabbard carefully on a side table. "Make yourself at home," Ethan said, "such as it is." He slipped off his jacket, flipped it around like a matador's cape, and placed it carefully on the back of a desk chair. When he plucked his PDA off the desktop and began to thumb through it, I took the opportunity to give the room another perusal. It was, after all, a record of Ethan's 400-year existence. If the stuff didn't give some clue to the puzzle that was Ethan Sullivan, I wasn't sure what would. Hands behind my back, I walked to the wall opposite the Fabergé egg, where an embroidered heraldic crest was mounted in a cherry wood frame. The crest bore an oak tree with red acorns, a symbol I'd seen before. I pointed to it, then glanced back at him. Ethan stood with one hand on the back of the chair, his blackberry in the other. "This is the same crest that's on the shield in the sparring room?" He glanced up, nodded, and turned back to his PDA. "It's my family crest, from Sweden." "What was your name?" I asked. Morgan had once told me that vampires switched identities every 60 or so years in order to keep from arousing too much human suspicion when they failed to age like their friends and families. Ethan Sullivan was his current name. But I assumed he hadn't been born to that name, not in Sweden nearly 400 years ago. "My family's name was Andresen," he said, clicking at the keys. "I was born Jacob Andresen." "Siblings?" He smiled wistfully. "Three sisters, Eliza, Annika, and Birit. Although I was often away from them. I was in the army, a man at arms, before our lieutenant asked me to run an errand. When I came back, information about our opponent's positions in hand, he promoted me." Apparently done with his messages, Ethan placed the PDA on the desktop, slid his hands into his pockets, and glanced up at me. I was an artillery captain when my time came. Ethan wasn't usually this talkative about his past, so I crossed my arms over my chest and gave him my full attention. When were you killed? When I was changed, he corrected. He gestured toward a spot at the crux of his left shoulder and neck. An arrow at dusk. Night fell, and the vampires emerged, stripping the battlefield of blood, including my own. It was easy to come by on a battlefield, of course, not that they were particular. Vampires were different then, closer to animal than human. They were roaming bands of scavengers, taking what blood they could find. Within that band, that first band, there was a leader, Baltazar. He'd been watching the camps, knew my position, decided I'd know enough about war, about strategy, to be an asset to the rest of them. So in a way, our changes had been similar. Ethan changed in the midst of a war, the victim of an attack. The change, although giving him life after a certain death, undertaken without his consent. Pulled into a corps of vampires to be a warrior, to offer his strategic services. Me, changed in the midst of Selena's battle for notoriety, the victim of her staged attack. Changed by Ethan to save my life, without my consent. Brought into Katagun House to be a warrior, a soldier protecting the house. When I began the genetic change from human to vampire, he drugged me. He said he didn't want me to have to experience the pain of the transition since it wasn't a transition I'd asked for. Maybe now I knew why. Ethan paused, his gaze on the floor, his eyes tracking as he recalled some ancient memory. When I arose after the change, I imagined myself a monster, something unholy. I couldn't go home, couldn't bring that home to my family. Not like I was, not like that. So I joined Baltazar and his band, and we traveled together for a decade. What happened after that? An enterprising young vampire, a vampire Baltazar had made, decided the band would be better under his authority, and that was the end of my relationship with those particular vampires. After that, I traveled. Wars were common in those years, and I had knowledge about strategy, skills. I joined a battalion here and there. Traveled south until I found a peaceful bit of earth to call my own. I lived off the land, learned to read and write, tried to build a new life and not attract too much human attention. My voice soft, I asked, "Did you ever marry?" "No," he said, shaking his head. "No. As a soldier, I didn't feel I had the luxury of keeping a family at home." He smiled wistfully. "My sisters were children enough for me. I was a coward, I suppose, that I didn't go back to them, didn't give them a chance to accept what I'd become. But that was a much different time, and I'd have been returning home a demon, a true monster. I couldn't bring myself to do it." "When did you join the house?" "Many, many years after I left Sweden, I met Peter. He founded Katagun House, and I joined him in Wales. And when he was gone, I became master. I moved the house here to Chicago." He spread his arms, gesturing to the mansion around him. "And here we are." "And here we are," I agreed. I knew that wasn't all of his history, but I knew enough about some of the more scandalous recent parts. His affair with Amber, his relationship with Lacey Sheridan, a former Katagun guard turned Sheridan House master. Not to ask more than I'd probably want to know. "A suggestion, Sentinel," he said. "Write down the things you wish to remember and keep those records close, secured. It's surprising how much you forget as the years go on." With that advice, he pushed off the desk and walked toward me. He stopped just in front of me, our toes close enough to touch, and just stood there. My heart began to pound as I waited for action, a touch or kiss, some end to the anticipation that lifted goosebumps on my arms. I opted to end the tension myself. "You shouldn't have shielded me when the shots were fired." He offered me an imperious look. "Ethan, it's my job. I'm supposed to protect you, not the other way around. Luke would have put my head on a pike if you'd taken a hit." How do you know I didn't? I opened my mouth, then closed it again. Did you? His eyes went to sultry slits. Do you want to look and see? Not especially. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Ethan arched an eyebrow and began to lean in. Then he reached around to pluck something from the table behind me. When he pulled back, folder in hand, I rolled my eyes at my reaction. The man just unbalanced me. He opened the file and began to peruse it, pacing across the floor as he considered its contents. I blew out a breath, relaxing incrementally at the realization that however he might flirt, we were really here on business. Whatever the attraction between us, he was first and foremost a leader of vampires. A knock sounded at the door.
Come in, Ethan said without glancing up.
The doors opened, but with considerably less fanfare than the last time food had been delivered. After giving me a devilish look, Margot wheeled in a cart, sans steel covers. The pizza had been mounted on a footed platter, an army's worth of supplies around it. Red chili flakes, grated Parmesan cheese, small glass bottles of water, napkins, silverware, wine glasses, and, of course, the wine. Ethan looked it over.
You did a respectable job of finding dinner this time, Sentinel.
I put my hands on my hips and looked over the tray and the plateau of pizza. Well, I said, even a born and bred Chicagoan needs a break from red hots and double cheeseburgers now and then. More's the pity, Margot snickered, and I smiled. I had a pretty good sense that I was going to like that girl. And then I was distracted by chocolate. I pointed at 2 3-leveled stacks of it in varying shades of brown.
Chocolate cakes?
Chocolate mousse cakes, Margot corrected. A chocolate genoise bottom, topped by layers of milk chocolate mousse and ganache. We're training a new pastry chef, and he wanted to practice his mousse-making skills. She glanced at Ethan, expectantly. Anything else I can do for you, Liege?
I believe you've made our sentinel happy enough for the both of us.
Very well. Bon appetit, she said, then bowed a little before turning for the doors.
Thank you, Margot, Ethan said, and she disappeared into the hallway, the doors closing behind her, but the bounty left behind.
We had our fill of pizza and ridiculously fabulous wine. Ethan had been right. Expensive or not, it paired incredibly well with the saucy, cheesy pizza. By the time Gabriel called, we'd moved to the sitting area, a landline conference phone and our wine glasses on the ottoman between us. I sat cross-legged on the floor, my boots kicked to the side. Ethan sat on the sofa, one leg crossed over the other. Gabriel hit it out of the park on his first at bat. Kitten, he asked. Did Sullivan give you a raise? I crossed my hands on the table and leaned toward the phone. Sadly, Gabriel, he did not. I believe my skills are sorely underappreciated.
I have trouble believing that's true, kitten, but vampires are vampires.
I had a feeling shifters use that phrase quite often, and not flatteringly, but when I glanced up at Ethan, he wore a look of amusement. He had one bent elbow on the chair back, his chin between his thumb and forefinger. His head was tilted, his smile crooked and kind of drowsy, as if he were actually relaxed.
Any developments in the investigation? He asked. Nothing I wanted to know about. Tony's bike was found about a half mile from the bar. The forensic team has it now. The Umbud is serving as liaison. He let us know the CPD's testing it for gunpowder residue, that kind of thing.
Ethan frowned.
I'm sorry to hear that. You and me both, Gabe said. This meeting is supposed to be about plotting out a new course for shifters, not tired old attitudes.
He sighed audibly.
Ah, well, shit is what it is, right? That's what we hear, Ethan said. So I assume that means Tony has been bumped up to the top of the suspect list. That would appear to be the case. It complicates things, of course. Endangering alphas isn't looked highly upon, as you might imagine. I don't want to bring the packs together with that kind of sword above our heads, but we may not have a choice. Have you settled on a location for the convocation?
We have.
We'll be at St. Bridget's Cathedral. It's here in the neighborhood.
I couldn't stop the words from popping out of my mouth.
St. Bridget's? You're meeting at a church?
We are indeed, Sentinel. Did you think shapeshifters were on the outs with all things holy?
A blush warmed my cheeks at the chastisement.
Of course not. It's just, well, it's a church. It's not the first place that comes to mind.
Especially as the location for a meeting of, as Gabriel had put it, hog-loving and jack-drinking bikers.
Fewer prying eyes and less collateral damage, Gabriel said.
Sullivan, I don't know what you'd like to see beforehand. I can have my people send Luke the building specs, that kind of thing.
Fine by me, Ethan agreed. I assume that's all you'll need from us tonight.
Actually, it isn't.
Gabriel paused for a moment, long enough for Ethan to offer me a look of curiosity. I shrugged.
I appreciate what you did tonight, both of you. You volunteered to jump into a conflict that isn't yours. And I can't thank Merritt enough for what she did with Berna. She took a risk, took a chance to protect her.
You did good, kitten. You did real good.
I smiled earnestly back at the phone. Thank you, sir.
Anywho, we've got a packed social gathering tomorrow night. Jeff suggested you two might be interested in joining us, meeting a few more of the Keens, getting a sense of who we are as a group. Partly, it's a thank you. And I don't think we'll have the same kind of security issues to worry about.
I glanced up from the phone to Ethan to gauge his reaction. His eyes were wide with surprise, his lips curled into a very self-satisfied grin.
We'd be honored, Gabriel. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, good. One small issue. We'll be at the Brex. They have a large house, as you know, so there's room to hold us all.
There was an awkward pause. And how are things between you and the Brex? I asked.
That prompted an even longer pause.
They've offered to host the potluck to help mend the fence, he said. Beyond that, it's between the Brex and the pack. Is that location going to cause any discomfort for you?
At my reassuring nod, Ethan offered,
We'll be fine. Good to hear it. 10 p.m. tomorrow. I'm out.
With that, he hung up.
Ethan reached forward and tapped a button on the phone, then looked at me.
Back into the den, I suppose.
It looks that way. I wonder if this will be our chance to mend fences with the Brex.
Or if we'll irritate them further by crashing a shifter party.
That had occurred to me, I agreed. Either way, there's only one thing to do about it now. I unkinked my legs and stood up again.
Ethan smiled lightly. 2 or 3 centuries of peace?
Well, that, sure.
But I was thinking chocolate mousse. I'd somehow become Ethan's culinary guide to Chicago. I'd gotten him to eat deep dish pizza, to try Chicago-style hot dogs, and to dive into a double bacon cheeseburger. I wasn't sure I could take the credit for the chocolate since Margot put the tray together, but I figured my sheer enthusiasm counted for something. While Ethan called Luke to advise him that Gabriel would be forwarding convocation materials, I plated up the chocolate cakes. When the columns of chocolate, from the cake layer to the pillowy mousse to the deep chocolate top, stood in the middle of crisp white dessert plates, I grabbed 2 silver forks. I turned to carry the plates back to the sitting area, but he was already standing behind me. I offered up a plate and fork and pricked the tip of it into the top of the dessert, piercing through the layers. I happened to glance up at him as I prepared to take a bite and found his gaze on me. His head tilted, a softness in his eyes.
What?
I asked.
A corner of his mouth tipped up.
You probably don't want to know.
Ha, I said, assuming his thoughts were lascivious,
then lifted the tears of velvet brown to my lips. I closed my eyes as I reveled in it. It truly was chocolate heaven, and Margot was a goddess.
Good?
He asked, his voice so low and slow, I wasn't sure he was asking about the dessert.
I told myself to focus on the dense taste of chocolate, and not on the question in his tone. When I opened my eyes again, he was still looking at me, his eyes crystal pools of green.
What?
I asked. He arched up a sardonic eyebrow.
I shook my head. Chocolate or no chocolate, we're not doing that.
Ethan humphed, then stepped forward.
You missed a little, he said,
raising his hand to my face. His fingers at my jaw, he swept his thumb across my lips. And while we stood there, staring at each other, he lifted his thumb to his own beautiful mouth and sucked away the chocolate. My lips parted, although my very skin was on fire and my lips felt swollen from his touch. I managed to whisper,
You aren't playing fair.
I'm not playing, Sentinel. For a moment, we stood silently, neither of us responding to the obvious invitation. Ethan took the plate and fork from my hands and placed them on the cart. He took my hand and pressed it to his chest, the crisp cotton of his shirt. His heart thudded beneath my palm, his blood racing beneath my fingertips. I had a sudden memory of the blood we'd shared, me on my old bed in Mallory's house, Ethan on his knees before me, his wrist offered to sustain me through the rest of the change. But even half-crazed from the bloodlust, I'd rejected it. I couldn't drink. I wasn't ready to take that step, especially not with him. Sharing blood had seemed too intimate a thing to do with someone I was already conflicted about. But then he'd carefully bitten his own wrist and offered it again. And while his control was usually momentous, he had surrendered and allowed me to see the silvering of his eyes. He had allowed me to see his want, his desire. That was enough for me. I'd gripped his arm and brought his wrist to my lips. I drank. For the first time, really, truly drank, and while I fed my fevered need, we stayed there together beneath an arc of hunger and desire and lust, strong enough to electrify the air. The memory hit me like a freight train, and I yanked back my hand, shocked by its intensity. As I looked at him now, I saw the knowledge in his eyes. He knew what I'd remembered, but also that the memory wasn't going to change my mind. You are so stubborn. I gave him a pointed look. You've always known that. You've known who I am from the very beginning. I know you aren't the same as the rest of them.
I wasn't made like the rest of them, I pointed out.
I didn't ask to become one of your vampires. I became a vampire because you chose to make me one. And what, Sentinel, did I make you?
The room was silent for a moment until I lifted my eyes to his. I wondered what he saw in mine as he stared back.
Did he see the same strong desire tempered by my own hesitation? Did I make you strong? He asked. Did I make you capable?
A corner of my lip lifted. I am who I am. You just made me vampire. While I still had the strength to do it, I took a few steps backward. We aren't far to dawn. I should probably head to my room.
Do you need me for anything else?
I need you for many things. Oh, but it was so easy to be flattered by the thought that a man so intensely handsome wanted me so fiercely. Of course, that was exactly the problem.
You want me for physical satisfaction.
When I got no response, I glanced up at him again, thinking my flippancy had angered him. But there was no anger in his eyes, just liquid, rich quicksilver. The color of hunger. My spine tingled, not just with arousal, but something baser, a kind of vampiric appreciation, an interest in whatever game we were beginning to play. The question was I prepared to lose? He moved forward and took my hand, then joined our fingers together, raising our linked hands between us.
You would be worth any cost.
Whether I'm worth it isn't the question.
My voice was lush and low, and surprised me with its depth. Apparently, the bravado I'd been faking with Lindsay hadn't been all a show. As a vampire, I had plenty of confidence in my feminine wiles. And, more important,
I would be the one to decide whether he was worthy of my attentions.
But why do you doubt me?
Because we've had this conversation before, at Mallory's, in the library.
I am beginning to remember.
He stopped, shook his head, then started again.
I am beginning to remember what it means to need things. Laughter, companionship, love.
He leaned forward and pressed his forehead to mine.
And I need you, Merritt. I swallowed. Those were words I hadn't expected to hear, hadn't been prepared to hear.
I want you, sure. I desire you, maybe. But not need. Not the admission of it, of the weakness he connoted with it. That simple four-letter word laid me bare, stripping away the defenses I'd so carefully constructed.
Ethan.
My voice was barely a whisper, barely enough to push through the thick silence, but there was still warning in my tone. A warning he ignored. That was when he moved, when he reached up, cupped my face in his hands, and pressed his lips to mine. He stayed there, his mouth on mine, for a long time before he finally drew away. But he kept his hands on my cheeks and kept his shining eyes on my face.
You undo me, Merritt, wholly and completely. You don't take me at my word. You challenge me at every opportunity. And that means when I'm with you, I am less than the head of this house, and I am more than the head of this house. I am a man.
He stroked my cheeks with his thumbs.
In my very, very long life, I need you more than I have ever needed anything.
This time, I didn't wait for him to move. Chapter 8, Hungry Eyes. I kissed him. I slid my hands around his waist as he slid his hands around my neck, tangled his fingers in my hair, and pulled me closer. He kissed me hungrily, greedily, as if he'd been starved for me. My body ignited, every cell on fire, and I kissed him back as if I couldn't get close enough. I nipped at his lips and tangled my tongue with his, magic beginning to spill through the room as passion flared between us.
Shirt off, I said, and he pulled back, his eyes widening at my boldness.
I smiled secretively. I guess working on my bravado had been worth it.
Ethan stepped back and licked his lips. I have waited a long time for you.
My fingers, which shook with nerves and anticipation, tugged at the bottom of his gray t-shirt, and ever so slowly pulled it up to reveal an ever larger band of perfect skin above his waist.
I don't want to rush you, he quietly said. But I have things planned yet before the sun rises.
Patience is a virtue, I told him. I slid my hands up the flat plane of his stomach, raising the shirt one brick of muscle at a time. When I'd gone as far as I could go, he lifted his arms and pulled it over his head. I will only entertain teasing for so long, he said, but closed his eyes and sighed, his muscles tensing beneath my hands as I traced a finger down the center of his stomach. I felt the sharp intake of breath and saw the pained pleasure on his face as I tugged the belt at his waist. Fingers nimbled by sword practice, I unfastened the buckle and pulled it through the loops, then dropped it to the floor. His eyes flashed open and flashed silver.
Merritt, he growled.
I glanced up at him through my bangs, slipped off my leather jacket, and pulled the elastic from my hair, letting it fall loose around my shoulders. Ethan stepped forward, sliding his hands into my hair and pressing his mouth to mine. After a long, hungry kiss, Ethan finally pulled back, chest heaving, lips parted. He stared at me, his pupils fully silver, and let his fangs descend. My heart pounded, the human nervous with anticipation, the vampire eager for action.
Merritt,
he said, then dipped his head toward my neck, letting his fangs graze the skin above the blood pulsing in my arteries.
You know what it would be like,
he whispered, his breath hot at my neck, enticing me to another memory of the blood we'd shared together.
You know how it would feel for you to take what I offer.
I shuddered from the memory, from the wine-warm taste of his blood on my lips, a flavor that had bloomed with heat and life and magic. It had been like drinking fine wine infused with pure electricity. And now he offered it again, to be twice bitten. I opened my mouth to answer, still not sure what words would spill from my mouth, but he pulled back. "First things first," he said, then took my hand and led me toward the double doors to his bedroom. I paused at the threshold, our arms stretched between us, hesitation suddenly overtaking me. He'd done this before with a woman who'd betrayed him, a woman assigned to provide him pleasure. Was I just the second round? Ethan glanced back, and I looked up at him, reluctance in my eyes. He smiled softly, then tugged me forward. When our bodies were aligned again, he lowered his lips to my ear. "More than I have ever wanted anything," he repeated, then stepped back again, eyebrow raised. "And you are vastly overdressed." I almost played coy, but I was past the need. The desire in Ethan's eyes made bashfulness unnecessary. I stepped inside the room and closed the doors behind us. Then I pulled the tank over my head and unzipped the suit trousers, letting them fall to the floor. That left me in the middle of Ethan Sullivan's apartments, wearing nothing but the length of my dark hair and a couple of scraps of black silk. And then I slipped away the silk. I could hardly have planned a better seduction. He let out a haggard breath, silvered gaze dropping to my bared breasts. Ethan wet his bottom lip, then glanced up, staring at me beneath mile-long lashes and half-closed lids. It was a look of such hunger and desire that my own fangs descended. With vampire speed, he stripped himself of jeans and boxer briefs, and then he stood naked before me, this man who'd seen the crumbling of empires and had a store of knowledge humans would never be able to match. The sight of this naked man, this vampire who had been my greatest enemy, my fiercest desire, pushed every rational thought from my head. The first seconds after I'd become a vampire, the world had shifted on its axis, becoming louder, brighter, more. But the entirety of that new world was nothing compared to the view before me. His sizable erection demonstrating the ferocity of his desire, his hungry eyes on me. Every muscle was defined, from his long, lean legs to the line of muscle at his hips, to the cording in his arms. Without waiting, like the predator he was, he stalked one foot at a time toward me. Instinctively, regardless of my own needs, I backed away from him, prey escaping from predator. That only enticed him more. I backed away until I hit the door, until there was nowhere else to run. Golden hair falling around his face, he half smiled at me, victory in his expression. He caught my wrists in his hands, raised them above my head, and pressed them to the wood behind us. "You are caught, Sentinel." His voice was rough. I looked up at him through my own half-hooded eyes. I wasn't trying to escape, Sullivan. Even in lust, we were challengers, our bodies the scorecards in our personal battle against each other. He kissed me, lips playing at mine, heat and friction and bare skin between us. And then he moved forward another inch and pressed his body against me, one thigh between mine, his marked arousal between us. He loosed my hands, and I wrapped my arms around him, curling my fingers into the skin at his back. His hands moved to my face, fingers at my jaw as he weakened me with kisses, with the teasing nips of his teeth, with his fangs, and the possibilities they presented. Without warning, Ethan dropped to his knees, his hands sliding as he moved, and then his long fingers were around my breasts. My eyes fell shut, my body arching forward into his hands. "Beautiful," he whispered, and then his mouth at my stomach, pressing kisses to my navel, his hands at my breasts, his fingers busy building a fierce and furious need. I groaned at the sensation,
lovely and inciting and completely unsatisfying all at the same time. I took a haggard breath and felt as if my skin were on fire. Ethan chuckled.
You seem to be enjoying yourself, Sentinel.
Slowly, I opened my eyes. No Sentinel, no Sullivan, Ethan and... I paused, not sure if I was willing to take that step, to offer up my first name, to give him that right.
He smiled softly, and Merritt, he decided for me, that crisp tone gone. He sounded not like a master among vampires, but a god among men.
He pressed his cheek to my stomach. I am undone, he said softly. I melted, my heart stuttering its rhythm. My hands found his hair, and I stroked the golden silk locks until he pulled one hand away and pressed his lips to the palm of my hand. And then he was on his feet again.
Bed,
he murmured harshly, and with a hand around my wrist, guided me toward it. When we reached it, he switched our positions and lowered me down. I watched, eyes wide, as he moved above me, crawling along the length of my body. And then the weight of his rangy form was on mine, and his lips and teeth were at my mouth. And his kiss turned frantic, lips and tongues and teeth and hands pushing, pulling, biting, nipping, trying furiously to get closer. He braced an elbow against the bed and used his other hand to torture me, fingertips slipping across my ribs, the teasing nearly bringing me off the mattress, and then across the flat of my stomach and the tops of my thighs. And then his fingers reached the core of my body, and I arched upward, even the slightest touch like licking flames across my skin.
Ethan.
He chuckled earthily. I've only just begun, Merritt, he warned, and then he began in earnest. Some minutes or hours or days later, when I lay boneless and well satisfied, Ethan raised his gaze to mine again. His eyes were silver, his fangs descended.
There is no going back, he said, not after this.
But I'd already made the decision to go forward. I had no interest in going back.
I want you, I told him, leaning up to press a kiss to his jawline.
That was proof enough for him. He moved forward again, and when our bodies were aligned, he pressed forward and pushed the air from my lungs. I arched my back, my hands reaching out for the headboard behind me, savoring the fire in my belly, the warmth of his body, the scent of his cologne, stronger now that we were together. In every possible way. My lashes fell again. One arm on the bed to support his weight, he cupped his other hand at my face.
Merritt,
he breathed across my lips. He'd said there was no going back, but he was asking me again without words. Was I sure? Was I ready? For the act, the deed, and everything else that would follow it? The changes that would result? I answered in the same way he asked, with my body. I arched my hips upward, pressed my nails into his skin, pulling him tighter against me.
Ethan.
He growled, then dropped his forehead to mine and began to move his hips, filling my body, bucking his own against mine. He moved perilously slow at first, his lips at mine, the movement a taunt, a tease, a promise of what could be. A promise of things to come.
Ethan,
I said, nipping back at his lips.
Yes, Merritt.
There was amusement in his voice. I will only entertain teasing for so long. He chuckled throatily. Someone told me once that patience is a virtue. I wrapped my legs around his waist. Someone wasn't in a hurry at the time. He moved forward with such force that I actually gasped, my eyes flashing open, as if my body were shocked by the primal feel of it. Someone should learn not to rush, he said, lips at my ear, then nipped at my neck.
Ethan,
I said, my lids already fluttering. He took that as an order and began to move fiercely, his lips peppering mine with kisses as he worked his hips against mine. My body burned from the inside, smoldered as he fanned the flames higher. I want your teeth on me, he hoarsely whispered. Now. The parts of my body that hadn't already been on fire instantaneously ignited. Hips still bucking, he lowered his head, putting his neck within Fang's reach. I slid my hands into his hair and pressed a kiss to the skin above his jugular, feeling his pulse beneath my lips. My fangs elongated again. Now, he said, and without a second thought, I leaned up and I bit. I tasted fire and wine and Ethan, his life's essence, his life's force, the drink of all drinks, the hunger of all vampires, his blood. My throat moved in time with his ferocious thrusting. Above me, he groaned, the sound thick and guttural, as if he was giving voice to ecstasy. Goosebumps lifted on my arms, magic seeping into the air as we took our pleasure. And then his body arched, and he put a hand at my jaw so he could look into my eyes, so he could watch the expression on my face. Merit, he said. The look in his eyes, possessive and primal, pushed me over. I sucked in a breath and called his name, fire spilling across my body, my eyes closing with the force of it, every muscle tensing, contracting, and, as the flame and power arched between us, releasing. Seconds or minutes or hours later, I clutched at his back, his lips at my ear, his breath and gasps, even as tremors shook my body, my breathing ragged. After a moment, Ethan pushed himself onto his elbows, kissed me roughly, and pressed his lips to my forehead. Then he dropped back to the bed, positioned himself on his side, and pulled my body against his. I nestled in front of him, his arm beneath my head, the warmth of his body cocooning mine once again. We lay there together quietly, even as the sun fought the horizon behind the shutters in his room. Two lovers savoring the fleeting cover of darkness. What's your favorite thing? He whispered, his lips at my ear. My favorite thing? I traced a fingertip across his long fingers, across the veins in his hands. Tell me something you haven't told another vampire. The question was as sad as it was sweet. He wanted to know something dear to me. As long as it was a secret I'd held dear from others. Something I hadn't yet brought across to the supernatural world into which he'd brought me. You know I'm a Cubs fan? Yes, although why remains a mystery. I glanced back at him. You're not a White Sox fan, are you? Of course not, he huffed out. I hardly follow baseball. But if you did? There was a silence for a moment. If I had to, I'd root for the Yankees. I let out a groan. I can't believe I just did what I did with a Yankees fan. You really should have given me a little warning, included a disclaimer, something. It's just baseball. Spoken like a Yankees fan. Anyway, you asked me what my favorite thing was. So one year, I made this pledge to get a baseball signed by every Cub. I was going to donate it to this charity thing my mom was involved in. I was 10, and I spent a lot of time that summer at Wrigley, at practice, trying to get the guys to sign it. It took me 4 full months to get all the guys to sign it. There was a holdout. For a merit? Say it isn't so. I know, right? Joe Mitchell was pitching back then, and he kept holding out on me. He knew what I was trying to do, but he also knew who I was. I managed to corner him once, but he wouldn't sign it until I got every other player's signature on my own. It was a test, I think. A character-building exercise. Let's see if this merit kid can do something on her own, not rely on her father. So did he sign? He did. Gave me a good job, kid, and everything, just like in the commercial. But by that time, it was nearly September, and I'd been following these guys around for months. I'd done what I set out to do, but that ball was hard to part with. You didn't keep it, did you? Oh no, I gave it up, but it killed me. That baseball was like a touchstone. Not because it was a collectible, although they did have a great season that year.
Go Cubbies.
I grinned. That's my boy. It was more like the baseball was a scrapbook, an album of how I'd spent the summer, a reminder of the games, the players, the heat, the hot dogs, the entire experience. I was silent for a moment. I wish I still had it, to remember the summer days, the sunlight, the heat.
It helps to have those touchstones, he said. Tangible memories of the people and places and things you wish to remember when they're gone.
Is that why you have so many collectibles?
Well, part of the reason is merely the passage of time. I've lived the lifetimes of many men. I've seen things, and I've brought forward my own touchstones, as you said. But yes, you're right. Those things remind us who we were. Being immortal doesn't make that any less important.
That makes sense, I said, but it took time for me to answer him, to force the words from my lips. The sun had risen, and it was pushing me asleep.
Sleep, Ethan said, as if he'd issued a command I couldn't disobey.
I did. Sometime during the day, as I lay groggy and barely awake, I became conscious of his hands on my abdomen. I made a questioning sound. He pressed a kiss to my shoulder.
I need you.
My body slow and sluggish, as if moving through water, I turned my head and squinted at the clock on his nightstand.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I grumbled and curled away from him, hitching up my knees and curving my hands into my chest. Go back to sleep. You can have me at dusk.
There was a rumbly laugh behind me before his fingers splayed and dipped between my thighs. He kissed my neck, then flicked his tongue against the tip of my ear.
Please, Merritt.
My eyes still closed, I smiled a grin of feminine pleasure. I'm pretty sure that was the first time Ethan had ever said please to me. How was I supposed to say no to that?
But then his voice turned more urgent.
Now, he growled, his erection against my back. In answer, I slid my hand behind me and around to the small of his back, pressing his body closer.
If we keep this up, I said quietly, we're going to kill each other.
He shifted to raise his body over mine, silver eyes staring down at me.
We're immortal. That would be quite a battle.
I pushed a lock of hair from his eyes.
A historic battle. A battle for the ages. You could write about it.
I credited the hour, the fact that the sun was high above us, but that seemed the funniest thing I'd ever heard. I chuckled and smoothed my hands down the sculpted muscle of his back.
Far be it from me to turn down a research project.
Some hours and two more interruptions later, the sun set again. I awoke, my stomach twinging nervously. We'd finally crossed the boundary between us.
Now what?
I yawned and stretched, still buried in piles of cool cotton blankets, then opened my eyes. Ethan stood beside his bureau, already showered and dressed in unbuttoned black trousers. He had just begun to button the button-down shirt that lay open across his torso. He glanced back, smiled politely, and finished fastening his shirt.
Good evening.
Good evening? I didn't mean to make it a question, not intentionally, but even I could hear the uptick at the end of the sentence. Ethan chuckled, then moved to the bed, leaned over me, and pressed a kiss to my forehead.
He must have seen the surprise in my eyes. I told you I wasn't your father.
I clearly wasn't giving you enough credit.
I'm sure that's not the first time.
He sat down on the edge of the bed, pulled on socks, then slipped into chunky black designer shoes. I sat up, pulling the comforter around me.
Nor will it probably be the last.
Ethan snorted, and when he was shooed, went back to the bureau and slid trinkets and change into his pockets.
It's 8:30. We'll need to leave for the Breck estate shortly. So if you'd like to pretty up before we leave, now would be a good time to do it.
I glanced down at the comforter. Probably the blanket would be a little too casual.
Probably, he agreed.
It goes against everything I believe in to ask you this question, but what would you have me wear? He perched one elbow on the bureau, then linked his fingers together.
They want us to see them in their natural habitat, so to speak. I assume they'd ask the same of us.
Armani for you?
He gestured at his suit pants and button-up.
And jeans, I assume, for you.
But of course. Opportunities to wear denim to the office don't come along very often in Cadogan House. Ethan chuckled, then pushed off the bureau and pulled a black suit coat from a valet stand.
I hear the master can be such a pain in the ass.
He definitely had his moments. Chapter 9. Willingly into the Den. I was on my way back down to the foyer, cleaned and redressed in jeans and a black short-sleeved button-up with a chic mandarin collar, my ensemble complete with katana and Cadogan medal, when my cell phone beeped. I immediately pulled it out, hoping it might be a text message from Mallory. It was a message, but not from an old friend, from a would-be new one. Noah had sent a simple question. Still deciding? Since I very definitely was, I erased the message and the evidence.
Good evening, sunshine.
I glanced behind me at the main staircase as I slid my phone back into my pocket. Lindsay was bounding downstairs, her blonde ponytail bouncing as she moved. She was on duty today and clearly prepped for a day in the house's operations room, clad in Cadogan black, her katana belted at her side. She reached the foyer, then walked toward me and propped her hands on her hips. You don't look nearly as tired as I expected. Maybe he was the cure for what ails you. I stared at her.
Excuse me?
She rolled her eyes. Oh, come on, Mare. We all heard you two at it last night, and some of today, actually.
But thank Christ, I say. About time you two did the deed.
Her approval notwithstanding, a blush powered by profound mortification crept up my face.
You heard us?
She grinned. You shook the foundations.
You threw a lot of magic in the air.
I was too stunned to speak. It had occurred to me that word might slip out, from Margot or otherwise, that I'd been in Ethan's apartments. It hadn't occurred to me that people could have heard us or felt the magic we'd spilled.
Dear God, I murmured.
Lindsay patted my arm. Don't be embarrassed. It's about time you two made the beast with two backs. I had to work to form words.
There are so many things wrong with that statement, I don't know where to start.
Start with the details, Sister Sledge. How was it? How is he? Was he as phenomenal as we've all imagined him to be? Seriously, spare no details, anatomical or otherwise.
I'm not giving you any details, anatomical or otherwise, I added before she could amend her request. There was disgust in her expression.
I can't believe you. You make it with the master and you're being tight-lipped?
She clucked her tongue.
That is weak.
At least give me the goods on the evening after talk.
Are you too official now? Dating? Relationshipping? What?
Well, we didn't really get into the details, but he was still there when I woke up this evening. No evening after regrets, as far as I know. And he knows I'm not interested in a fling. I've made that abundantly clear.
I grinned a little.
She grinned back. That's my girl. Way to show him who's boss. Are we actually debating who's boss of this house?
We glanced over simultaneously. Ethan stood at the bottom of the stairs, golden hair around his face, hands in his pockets, newspaper under his arm.
Good evening, liege of mine. How was your day?
Ethan arched an imperious eyebrow at Lindsay, then glanced at me.
Nice shirt. We need to make a brief detour before we take on the shifters.
Oh, Lindsay knowingly intoned. You're going to Navarre House?
We're going to Navarre House, Ethan confirmed.
I blinked when he'd said detour. I'd immediately imagined grabbing a hostess gift. A trip to Navarre House wasn't on the list. I'd never been there before, and the idea of going now didn't thrill me. And why not, you ask?
Brief review. I'd be facing down an ex-boyfriend for the first time since our official breakup, while on the arm of the boy he'd thought I'd been cheating with, and only hours after I'd actually had sex with him.
Fabulous.
Does she know? Lindsay asked, bobbing her head toward me.
Standing right here, do I know what?
I'm going to tell her, Ethan said, but we're short on time. I forgot to call Luke. Please tell him I want to talk before dawn to review plans for the convocation.
Aye, aye, Liege, she said, but leaned into me before she walked away. Seriously, well done.
And I mean that. I grinned after her and raised a quizzical gaze to Ethan.
What do I need to know?
And why are we going to Nevers?
He gestured for me to follow him, then headed toward the basement stairs. When I fell in line beside him, he pulled the paper out from under his arm. It was a copy of the day's Chicago Sun-Times. He flipped it open, then turned it my way.
Oh my God, I murmured, pulling the paper from his hands.
The headline on the front page, read, Ponytailed Avenger Saves Patrons in Shootout. A picture of me helping Berna into the ambulance was set below the headline. And there was one more surprise, the byline. Nick Breckenridge was listed as the author of the article.
As I carefully took the basement stairs behind him, I read through the first part of the story, which discussed the shooting and my emergency work. So far, so good. But I had no idea why Nick Breckenridge, of all people, had written it. It wasn't that writing a front-page story wasn't his thing. He was an investigative journalist with an impeccable reputation. He just didn't like me very much.
How? Why?
Perhaps you turned the Breckenridge tide from animosity to cover story. We stopped beside the basement door.
This can't be hero worship.
You know how Nick feels about me.
You heard Gabriel's hesitation when he mentioned the Breckenridge house. Maybe, like Nick and Gabriel are still on the outs. Gabriel did apologize, after all. He wasn't exactly thrilled about Nick pissing off vampires.
Okay, but convincing a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter to write a story glorifying a vampire he isn't particularly happy with, would take a lot of pushing. I'm not sure Gabe would want to waste political capital on me. Besides, I can't imagine he'd put pressure on Nick to put us on the front page of the Sun-Times. Gabe doesn't want that kind of attention. It would raise too many questions about why armed vampires were in the bar, or risk the paparazzis thinking it was some kind of new vampire hotspot. He definitely doesn't want that. There has to be another reason. And that mysterious reason made me wonder what price I'd have to pay with Nick. I wasn't sure whether it was better or worse if he wrote the story because he got an unsubtle nudge from his boss.
Probably the same way I'd feel if I got a nudge from a master, I muttered.
What was that?
Nothing.
What does this have to do with going to Navarre House?
The story gets considerably nastier as it goes along.
What kind of nasty?
It reminds the reader that the vampires of Navarre House weren't nearly as, shall we say, philanthropic as Cadogan vampires.
It talks about the park murders?
Those were the results of Selena's murderous escapade through Chicago's parks and the U of C campus. I was supposed to have been victim number two, at least before Ethan found me.
He nodded. That's why Morgan wants to see us. Since you're featured in the story and we're friends with Nick, he probably assumes we had something to do with its creation.
Calling us friends gave my relationship with Nicholas Breckenridge a lot more credit than it deserved. Ethan punched in his code, then opened the basement door.
And how are you feeling about said article? I asked, following him into the garage.
Well, evidently I'm dating the ponytailed Avenger, so I feel pretty good about that.
I stopped to offer him a snarky look. When he walked past me to the car, smug grin on his face, I rolled my eyes. But I hardly meant it. He had said dating, after all.
We were on the road a few minutes later, silence reigning in the Mercedes as I finished reading the story.
The article read like a primer on Cadogan and Nevers, from the House's leadership positions to their histories. It also mentioned that a woman named Nadia was Morgan's new second. I hadn't known he'd promoted someone. On the other hand, I hadn't really thought to ask him about it. That omission probably said a lot about our lack of potential as a couple. Where'd the information come from? I asked, glancing up to realize we'd moved from Hyde Park to Lakeshore Drive. Nevers was located in Chicago's Gold Coast, an area of chichi townhouses, condos, and mansions near the lake and north of downtown Chicago. That was my second question, Ethan answered darkly. Right behind wondering what impolitic acts our young master of Nevers might take upon seeing it. He glanced over at me. Have you talked to him recently? Not since the fight. There was a moment of silence in the car, the tension evident by the faint hum of magic. I see, he said. There was disapproval in his voice. I tensed, anticipating an argument. Is there something you'd like to say about that? When he looked over, his expression was mild. I couldn't tell if it was forced or not. Not at all, he said, but it might add to his irritation at having seen the story. I thought back to the things Morgan had said in our last two conversations, the accusations he'd thrown, the condescension in his tone. Yeah, he's probably not going to be in the greatest of moods. Any suggestions? Barring any complete attitude adjustment,